In a healthy democracy, everyone has the right to free speech. But what happens when the cacophony grows so loud we lose the sight of the truth? In an increasingly noisy world, Professor Philip Pettit says we need to rethink the way we conceive of free speech as a concept. Dr. Pettit is a distinguished professor of philosophy at the ANU, as well as a professor of human values at Princeton University. Welcome to RN Drive.
Thank you.
How are our current notions of free speech outdated?
Well, the notion of free speech really goes, it's an Enlightenment ideal, wonderful ideal in its way, but like most of these ideals, it does need rethinking, you know, when institutions shift. And what I believe is we really need to rethink free speech, what it involves, the institutional protections we need to give it now in this sort of age of social media and of this incredible sort of access to the news, to public airwaves on the part of everyone, which makes it in one way very, very attractive, a democracy of voices, but in another way introduces a sort of anarchy and which you get fake news emerging, you get fake science emerging, it gets more and more difficult to distinguish the truth from the dubious and from the downright false.
So that's quite a radical concept to rethink free speech, because I think it's one of those central pillars of Western democracy, the defence, the belief in free speech. So if I were to be practical or ask you in a practical way, how would free speech look in your perfect world?
Well, the world, if I can just go back a little bit, the world for which the ideal, as we know it now, was really designed was a world in which the real threat was one voice dominating all. It might be the voice of the monarch, the sovereign, or of a church, of an orthodoxy, in which you censor the other voices, just the one voice was heard. And in that context, as an Enlightenment ideal, it is an ideal under which you let numerous voices be heard, which would check and balance one another, which would establish a marketplace of ideas, as it was often came to be called, in which the truth would eventually out because you'd hear all sides. People would be able to contest one another and bystanders, so to speak, the rest of us, would be able to discern what looked the most reliable. Now, what's happening at the moment, as we're all aware, I mean, this isn't news, is it really? What's happening now is that with social media, with Twitter, with all of the massive sort of wonderful avenues of whereby people can, well, I was going to say get their voices heard, but actually more speak whether or not they get their voices heard. In that sort of world, it's very, very hard to discern any longer what's the truth and what's not. The trouble is, in the older context, there was always contestability. So when one spoke, another could contest. There could be something of a debate. I mean, it might be very subdued, it might be extended over time, but it was a genuine sort of exchange. Whereas nowadays, there's so many voices that people retreat to their silos, you know, retreat to their niches, retreat to hear the voices that they're predisposed to hear in their own neck of the woods, so to speak, in their own comfort zone. And if, as you get people retreating to their own comfort zone, you lose a public conversation, you lose exchange, and you actually really end up with a divided community where everyone is sure they've got a hold of what they think of as the truth. But actually the truth is we've lost the sort of discipline that makes free speech valuable. You know, there's a wonderful remark by Daniel Moynihan, the US senator long ago, when he said that everyone is entitled to their opinion, but they're not entitled to their facts.
That's right.
And that is the problem, that the alternative facts, to use that wonderful phrase that Kellyanne Conway invented, I suppose, in justifying her president, you know, President Trump, that, well, he had a way with alternative facts. I mean, that is so frightening at one level.
So aren't people entitled to say what they like, even if it is not based on fact? Because in this marketplace you talk about, and I agree it's become more fractured, but we have reputable organisations that correct the facts. The ABC does that. We try and do that here every night. We're accountable for that. We correct the facts. The facts are, as you say, not in dispute. But people have the right to say whatever they like, though, don't they?
They absolutely do. But When I say they have the right to, with all freedoms, with all rights of this kind, like the right to buy and sell in the marketplace, a precondition, so to speak, of people being given that freedom and the freedom to be worthwhile is, first of all, that everyone can access it, and that's fine. No problem with speech, no problem for that matter with buying and selling if you've got something to buy or sell. But just as in the market, we realize that if everyone does this, there can be very bad side effects, which you've got to protect against. And the law, which gives people these freedoms, does protect against it. So, for example, you protect against externalities in the market. You protect against monopolies and so on that will destroy the value of being a freedom of the market. Now, freedom of the marketplace of ideas, up to now, it's fine to let everyone have their say because there weren't so many, so to speak, platforms you could speak from. And you got the emergence of bodies like the ABC or the various newspapers and so on, or the various, of course, commercial stations as well, which could maybe have different voices they amplified, but they would check and balance one another. The trouble with what's happening now with the advent of the social media, the avalanche, really, of voices, is that that ceased to be the case. And I fear that it may even happen in Australia, which is among some of the best, in my experience, countries in this respect. But in America, for example, it used to be the case you knew whatever voices were out there that you could trust the Washington Post, the New York Times, the Los Angeles Times, a number of, you know, radio stations and so on. Now there are so many voices that that sort of sense that we can all trust these media has been lost. People have retreated to, you know, their own, and the mainline radio stations have to some extent, and television stations and press and newspapers, they've gone along with this by each, you know, looking now for their niche audience. They've become more politicized, really, and lost that sense that we used to have that they would be our editors.
Well, they're narrow casting more than mass audience casting, right? The casting
exactly,
to a particular
a nice way of putting
audience.
It, right? It used to be that it was fine for everyone to broadcast because the voices were few enough to check and balance one another, and there were, besides, there were the voices that emerged associated with things like the ABC, The Age, The Australian, whatever, that could be trusted to carry solid news. That can come under real pressure, even in Australia, and it has elsewhere, and I think more and more in the world has come under pressure, as these commercial organizations find it more profitable to narrowcast. And that's because of the effect of people narrowcasting in the social media world by finding their comfort zone, their niche, their own particular silo.
Okay, so there is, you say, a problem essentially in the distortion of facts and therefore with freedom of speech and how we think about it. But of course, all of these things lead to having to legislate law reform. How does it look in terms of law reform? How can your idea of, I suppose, in some way policing the facts, how can you achieve that in a way that doesn't repress speech?
I don't really have a pat answer. I'll give you one suggestion. But what I really do feel strongly is that we need, as a community, I mean worldwide, but here in Australia, we need to get together and to think about how to handle this problem. And that needs to involve the engineers who know the internet, know how it works, and knows what's possible. It needs to involve politicians, it needs to involve public servants, administrators, it needs to involve, dare I say, philosophers and people in the social sciences and so on as well. One sort of suggestion, just to give you an idea of, I think, what we should be thinking of, is with political news in particular, which is so important to our democracy, that we don't have people feeding off narrow niche silos, as I've been calling them, where they can just be picking up absolute falsehood, you know, if it's in the interest of those who are selling it. In these cases, I think it's very important that on social media, that any message that comes through of a political kind comes through with the signature. Like we have on television or radio now, this message was authorized by. So you've got a signature for every message that's put out. That was not true at the time. Brexit was not true at the time of the election of Trump. These are the two great elections where we know the media had, I believe, a very distorting influence. And they have a signature that they have to attach. And that signature has to have a web page in which all the messages they put out are available. Now, only the investigative journalist or someone like you will go to that web page, but it's there as a check. But apart from that, of course, you have to have some register of these web pages, and you have to have somebody that makes sure that there isn't a web page that, for example, is like Cambridge Analytica, you know, that's operating for some commercial or political interest that's wholly hostile to the system you're living in. This body has to be authorized by law. There has to be legislation. But it can be kept at arm's length from government because, of course, there's always a temptation.
Well, this is the thing, because it does sound, and the free journalist in me thinks that sounds like a heavy regulatory burden. And, of course, a free press wants to operate outside of a free, you know, out of a sort of heavy regulation. That's the point of freedom. Is that the risk of what you propose?
I think what you've got to realise, if I may say in response, Patricia, is that it's not the case that we've got freedom as a natural sort of thing that comes to us unregulated.
No, in fact, people have fought for
freedom. The law creates our freedom. It's the law. You're only free in doing something like speaking, like buying and selling in the market, like moving wherever you wish, like accepting what occupation is available to you, provided you can do that without seeking anyone's permission. And in order, that means without having to depend on anyone giving you the okay, that means the law has got to protect you. So freedom is actually an artifact of law, freedom in that proper sense of not being stood over by another person. But the other side of law is that it's got to protect these spheres of activities, these liberties like freedom of speech, freedom of the market, freedom of movement and so on. It's got to protect them. But at the same time, it got to guard against side effects that are bad for the community as a whole. We're used to doing it in the market, although we're doing it less well than we used to, in guarding against externalities, in guarding against monopolies, in guarding against the erosion of natural resources, for example. We now have to learn to do it with free speech. Up to now, it's been fine to let speech roll with protections, of course, maybe against hate speech and, you know, speech that disturbs public order. But that's about the size of it up to now. But I think at this point, we've got to introduce some more protections. Now, they needn't be, I think, heavy-handed. I mean, what I was suggesting was a register of websites. It just means you can't get on your Twitter and send out some absolute rubbish. Or you can't establish a bot, you know, literally an automatic thing that will send out messages, churn them out, and get feedback on the sort of person you are because of the big data available, and then put out more pap that's likely to appeal to you. I mean, we know in America, for example, that if you were a Republican identified with certain sensitivities under the Cambridge Analytica sort of drive, if, as I understand, they were one of the main players, and that if you were a Republican, they picked up that you were worried about immigration, you got message after message about immigration. Most of it patently false. I mean, really patently false. If you were a Democrat likely to vote for Hillary Clinton, you got messages that kept telling you they're all crooked. Trump is crooked. Hillary is crooked. To get you not to vote. I mean, that's the sort of tapering you can have. Bots can do this. You know, you can set up these machines. Now, we have to protect ourselves against that it's a misuse of speech. Free speech ceases to be a value if it's speech of that sort of wholly unlicensed kind that can drown us out. You know, an analogy that that I sometimes use is, you know, we know you can't see the stars if there are too many lights from the centre of Melbourne, you can't. You go outside into the countryside and you can. That's light pollution, we call it, when you can't see the stars. The trouble is we're suffering from a speech pollution, as it were, noise pollution that's drowning out what is really worth hearing. There's no testing going on. There's no contesting going on by different voices because there are too many of them and there's a retreat to the niches.
Philip, it's such an interesting conversation starter. I think we're just starting it, but thank you so much for coming in.
Real pleasure. Thank you.
Philip Pettit is a professor of philosophy at the ANU and a professor of human values at Princeton University. This is RN Drive.